Major funding for On Point is provided by Liberty Mutual for all your auto, home, life, and business insurance needs. Liberty Mutual. Responsibility. What's your policy?
From WBUR Boston, I'm Tom Asbrook, and this is On Point. Iranian-American Roxana Saberi was born in Fargo, North Dakota. Iranian father, Japanese mom, all-American girl, a North Dakota beauty queen who dreamed of being a foreign correspondent. 6 years ago, she moved to Iran to report for NPR, the BBC, and more, found a boyfriend, was working on a book, and 12 days ago was convicted after a one-day trial of spying for the United States and sentenced to 8 years in prison. Here she is in 2007 reporting for NPR about Iran's morality crackdown targeting women.
When 21-year-old Zahra put on her red lipstick to match her red jacket one recent morning, she didn't think her fashion taste would land her in police custody.
Now, Roxana Saberi herself is in jail on hunger strike, her parents say, and very frail. Journalists abroad in Paris have begun hunger strikes in sympathy with her own. President Obama is on the case. So is Iran's president, Mahmoud Ahmadinejad. This hour, On Point from Fargo to a Tehran prison cell, we're looking at the hunger strike and high politics of Roxana Saberi. You can join the conversation. What do you see here? A prisoner, a pawn, Iranian politics, geopolitics? Are you tying a yellow ribbon for Roxana Saberi? You can also comment on our website, onpointradio.org, or on Twitter and Facebook at On Point Radio. Senator Byron Dorgan, Democrat of North Dakota, calls this whole thing a shocking miscarriage of justice. You may have heard over the weekend on Sunday, the day that Roxana Saberi turned 32 years old, her birthday, her father, Reza Saberi, announced that his daughter had started a hunger strike. Here he is speaking to NPR's Weekend Edition Sunday about her decision to go on that strike.
She didn't wait for us to persuade her not to do so. I was trying to say that, well, this is going to be harmful to her, but she said that she's determined to do this. She didn't want to change her mind.
Determined to do it, didn't want to change her mind, and her father there in Iran trying to get his daughter out of prison, her mother there as well. In that same interview, Roxana's father handed the phone over to his wife, Akiko, who spoke about seeing her daughter in prison.
He was weak, he didn't look healthy, and I really knew he had been under so much pressure, and he didn't know what else was going on outside the prison. We had to tell her the world was with her. The whole world.
We're paying attention today, right here, right now. Joining us first from Culver City, California, is Mike Schuster, diplomatic correspondent, foreign correspondent at large for National Public Radio. He worked with Roxana Saberi over the years and was just in Iran in February. Mike Schuster, thanks very much for being here.
Hello.
What do you make of this story?
Well, I think of all the choices, the political pawn is the most feasible. Roxana was seized at the end of January. It's significant that it was after the inauguration of Barack Obama and after the publication of the indication that the Obama administration was looking to open up and engage with Iran. And I think that there are significant political forces in Iran that don't want to do that. And one way that they could, I think they thought, stymie it was to seize an Iranian-American reporter, put her on trial for espionage, and hope that the reaction in the United States would be such that it wouldn't support an opening to Iran. And I think that's what's going on.
Maybe one woman in jail and turn around the whole budding, reconstitution of a relationship?
It's not only that. It's certainly not only that. But I think that it has become a sensitive issue. It has reached the desk of the President of the United States. You are doing programs like this.
Sure.
It was the lead editorial in the New York Times one day last week. And when Roxana was first seized, nobody was paying attention. In fact, nobody knew for 2 weeks. And we put her father on the air when he found out about it. It's slowly built. And it's interesting that it's slowly built as the Obama administration has seemed to reach the end of its review on Iran policy and is trying to decide what to do. It certainly won't be the only issue. There are other issues as well. And it's not the first time that the Iranian authorities have seized Iranian Americans in Iran and made them an issue. The same thing happened, or similar things happened in 2007 with
right.
several Iranian-American scholars.
She was originally held for buying a bottle of wine, and then they said she was detained for reporting without proper credentials. True, I guess. And now espionage, charged with spying for the United States, 8 years in prison. That's a long time. We'll look at the domestic politics and the geopolitics, but Mike, give us a sense. I mean, first of all, just of the prison, Evin Prison in Tehran. I've heard pretty bad stories out of Iranian prisons.
Well, I think that most of the most of the prisoners are male, and I think that's where the really horror stories have come from. It's not entirely clear to me what conditions women are held in Evin prison. My sense of it is that it's better than where male prisoners are held, but it's the place where political prisoners are kept, and it can become quite brutal at times. There, in fact, was one female Iranian Canadian reporter who died in Evin prison several years ago. It's by no means easy to get through the experience.
I've read that she's sharing a cell with a couple of women there, that she's out of the cell just a couple of times a day. Her mother and father, I don't know if they're both still there. The father's still there, certainly, saying
right.
she is on hunger strike, very frail and very weak, the latest from them. An Iranian judge saying, no, she's not. She's fine, thank you. What do you make of that?
Well, I make of that the same that I've made of all the statements that have come out of this case. As a reporter, I'm skeptical of everything that the Iranians have said, that the Iranian authorities have said, including the initial notion that she was arrested for buying an illegal bottle of wine. I think that she has been under pressure by the authorities to say things to her father when she's been on the phone with him before her father got to Iran. And there is some evidence that the authorities have told her, if you say the things that we tell you to say, you'll get out soon. And each time that has happened, they haven't made good on their promise. It's strange that her father would say that she's on a hunger strike and the Iranian authorities would say, no, she's not. But that might suggest that they are sensitive about what might happen in this case and that it might not entirely they might not entirely be in control of what happens now.
The deputy prosecutor for the Revolutionary Court told Iranian news media, I'm looking here at the LA Times report, saying that Roxane Isaberi had confessed to the charges. And then her father saying that she had said in court that her earlier confessions were not true, told him that she'd been tricked into believing that she'd be released if she cooperated. 8-year sentences sounds pretty scary.
That's right. And that's why I think that she has been psychologically coerced, that I think she believed what her jailers were telling her initially, and she cooperated with them in such a way as to fulfill the hope that they would release her quickly. And I think there's been a couple of times, including when she is alleged to have pled guilty. In fact, when that occurred, the Iranian authorities said that she had accepted the case. That was the translation of what they said. And that wasn't even explained what that meant. And I think still today it suggests that there's manipulation of her at every stage in this trial. I think that's why she has decided to go on a hunger strike, to finally push back.
It may be her only way to cut through here. Give us a sense of her, Mike. I'm looking at a couple of photographs here, well, a couple of glamour shots maybe from, I don't know, from some TV work. But then here's another where she's, looks like in Tehran, she's wearing the whole black, you know, headscarf and robe. She's videoing something here. She's been there 6 years. It's a long time. I mean, she really became interested in her father's home country, dual citizenship she has, Kurdish-Iranian film director Bahman Gobadi, her boyfriend, rather prominent kind of indie filmmaker there. He describes being at her sentencing, saying he stood at the gate, she was taken away after the verdict, I had one chance to catch her eyes, and then she was waving and pleading and gone. He said, I fell down on my knees, sat on the ground, weeping. Give us a sense of Roxane herself, Mike.
Well, I met with her over the years whenever I made a trip to Iran. She was a great contact. She was one of the few Americans who were there that you could sit down and talk with and get a sense through, you know, from day to day and month to month, year to year, of the politics of Iran and what was going on, the various issues. She followed everything closely. My sense was that she had started out wanting to be a TV reporter, and she worked for a group in London called Feature Story, and she did freelance video pieces that then Feature Story circulated to the English language television around the globe. And I met her about 5 years ago and encouraged her to approach NPR to do freelance work, and she was very much interested in NPR. And she started to do occasional pieces and a lot of new spots for NPR. And then about 2 years ago, her press card was pulled, and I met with her after that, and I was concerned about that, because without a press card, I think she became vulnerable. And she didn't have a good explanation for it. But they didn't expel her from the country. And she continued, I think, quietly to try to stay under the radar and work as a journalist, but not intensely. And they seemed to allow her to do that for the last 2 years. And then all of a sudden, out of the blue, as far as we know, she was arrested and charged with illegal reporting. Or at least said to be charged with illegal reporting. She's very smart, and she followed things very closely. She thought Iranian culture and being in Iran, as I remember, was just fascinating, and she didn't want to give it up unless she had to.
And now we've got Iranian politics swirling around here. Big election coming. We'll talk about that. We've got geopolitics swirling around. As you say, the Obama administration has reached out. Of course, this after the years when the Bush administration reportedly was putting, millions of dollars into a destabilization campaign of the regime in Iran. Could be some backwash here, at least in Iranian eyes, from that. We've got a lot to talk about, and we'll go to Fargo, North Dakota, to get more of a sense of the young woman sitting in prison in Tehran. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking this hour about Iranian-American journalist Roxana Saberi in prison in Iran on an 8-year sentence, espionage sentence, and we're told on hunger strike. Mike Schuster has joined us. He's diplomatic correspondent for NPR, foreign correspondent at large for National Public Radio. Was just in Iran in February. Stone Roxana there and her work for quite a while. She did work for the BBC, for NPR. Roxana Saberi was first arrested for buying a bottle of wine, quote unquote. Now she's in prison for spying. What is going on here? What's a former Miss North Dakota, a Fargo girl, doing sitting in prison in Iran? How do you see the politics, the geopolitics here? Let's get another little bit of the sound. We don't want to forget her as she sits in this cell, and who knows what all swirling around here. Here she is, May 15th, 2007, reporting for National Public Radio, NPR, on reaction to Iran's decision then to talk to U.S. officials about security in neighboring Iraq. These talks in Baghdad were one of the few official face-to-face meetings between the U.S. and Iran.
One hardline newspaper said the U.S. has finally been forced to recognize Tehran as a major player in the region, while another strongly criticized Iran's decision, saying that negotiating with the U.S. means, quote, shaking hands with Satan and dancing with wolves. Many here believe that Iran and the U.S. have deep differences and that U.S. hostility toward Iran has intensified in recent years.
Roxana Saberi there in 2007. Now she's in prison. 8-year sentence in Iran. And that's a long time. Reporters Without Borders protesting on her behalf in Paris. They've got several reporters I'm reading here, maybe on the Champs-Élysées out in front of Iranian Air, on hunger strike themselves in sympathy with Roxana Saberi. The London Times calls her a political hostage. We're joined right now from Washington by Karim Sajadpour. He's a scholar with the Carnegie Endowment for International Peace. He first met Roxana in Tehran in 2004. Karim Sajadpour, thanks very much for joining us.
My pleasure.
Mike Schuster has been beginning to paint the picture here. Pull the curtain back a little further on Iranian politics, geopolitics. What do you see swirling around this Iranian-American woman in prison?
I think everything Mike has said so far has been spot on in the sense that the Obama administration, the United States, has reached an internal consensus that it's time to engage Iran to try to forge a new relationship with Tehran. I don't think the Iranians have reached that same consensus. And I think there are hardliners in Tehran who are a minority within the ruling elite, but at the moment they have an inordinate amount of authority. And they fear that politically and financially they stand to lose in the event of a U.S.-Iran détente or confidence building or rapprochement. And throughout the last 3 decades, we've seen that whenever the U.S. has made efforts at reaching out, they've done something to try to sabotage or torpedo it. And I would put Roxana's case, unfortunately, within this context.
Now, there's geopolitics clearly here, but also domestic politics. Iran has a presidential election coming up, June 12th. It's right around the corner. That puts Mahmoud Ahmadinejad, on the ballot. What about just domestically? I mean, this is U.S.-Iran, but it's also Iran-Iran, Karim.
Certainly. I mean, this is a very opaque system. So it's we can speculate in a number of different ways. I actually do believe this is much more about, historically, Iran likes to provoke international crises to forward domestic political agendas. But with regards to the presidential elections, I don't think any particular faction benefits from having Roxana imprisoned. What we may see, however, is President Ahmadinejad coming out and pardoning her publicly, like he did with the British sailors, if you remember, a couple of years ago, to project this aura of magnanimity, or the supreme leader doing something like that. But again, I'm happy to talk about domestic Iranian politics, but I think Roxana's case is more related to specifically the relationship between the United States and Iran.
Of course, that relationship has been so contentious for so long, was so much at the heart of the birth of the Islamic Revolution, Mike, in Iran, that it's pretty well burrowed into domestic politics. I mean, I'm reading here, this is an op-ed piece from Muhammad Sahimi in The Times, saying that hardliners in Iran feel threatened by any rapprochement with the United States. Because, for one, it would strengthen, they fear, reformist and democratic groups in Iran as the fear of American threat might dissipate, and that the hardliners, that is the Islamists, terrified by prospects of a velvet revolution there. What do you say, Mike?
Well, it's certainly true that during the Bush administration, the United States did a good job of playing the role of the great Satan in the eyes of conservative leaders in Iran, and it was it made it possible for them to dig in their heels and resist change. There were many on the reformist side, especially during the 8 years of the Mohammad Khatami administration, that wanted to change things. The conservatives, even though there were conservatives who might have wanted to open up to the United States, I think some do, but they didn't want the reformists or the liberals to get credit for it. And at the same time, President Bush put Iran on the axis of evil list and spent money covertly in ways that I think the Iranians and those of us in the United States that followed this weren't quite sure how they were spending the money to undermine the regime or change the regime. And it gave the conservatives the opportunity to fight back by arrests like this one, arrests like the four Iranian-American scholars in 2007 who were accused directly of wanting to advance the so-called Velvet Revolution in Iran. One of them, Haleh Esfandiari, no, two of them, Haleh Esfandiari and one other were interviewed and then were put on television, and the claim was made that they hadn't confessed to these so-called crimes, in much the same way that they've said that Roxana Saberi has confessed to the crime. And all it is the manipulation of the political situation for the benefit of the conservatives who want to maintain their control.
So a lot of symbolic manipulation in a way going on here, but real stakes at the same time. We've got big issues. We're going to hear more about Roxana herself from Fargo, but let's get a couple callers here. John in Lunenburg, Massachusetts. John, you're on the air.
Hi, Tom. Thanks. Great job, as usual. Wanted to just make a comment about a possible motive for this this arrest and trial of Roxana. Mm. I've been following the human rights situation for many years in Iran, especially with the attempts to eliminate the Baha'i community there. And friends of mine in Iran and here reminded me that there are several Iranian operatives, intelligence operatives, in custody by U.S. forces in Iraq. And among many other motives, which I think your guests have mentioned, they thought that this could also be an attempt for a swap at some time in the future.
Yeah, I'm glad you raised that, John. Thank you very much. Karim Sajjadpour, what about it? This goes back to, 4 or 5 Revolutionary Guards captured by U.S. forces when they were putatively training insurgents in Iraq. This is in Erbil back in early 2007. Could this be an effort to swap Roxana for Revolutionary Guards, Karim?
It's a possibility. Again, this is such an opaque system that we can only at times speculate. And, you know, mm-hmm. there's also another American citizen in Iran, Robert Levinson, former FBI agent who we haven't heard from in a couple of years.
Is he in prison?
Well, we don't know. He's disappeared in mm-hmm. Tehran for a couple of years now. His family doesn't know his whereabouts. Mm. So you know, it's certainly within the realm of possibilities. But I think the timing of Roxana's case, of her imprisonment, was in a way that it was, as Mike was saying earlier, it was exactly the same time that the Obama administration has really tried to reach out and engage Iran. And it just strikes me that that timing has more to do with Roxana's imprisonment than these Revolutionary Guardsmen who have been in detention in Iraq for several years now. Mm. So you know, certainly it's such an opaque system. We can at times only speculate. But we're talking now for 3 decades. We have empirical evidence that these spoilers, as they call them, as I call them. They come out of the woodworks whenever the U.S. is making overtures.
Let's get a call from Dan in Portsmouth, New Hampshire. Dan, you're on the air.
Hi, Tom. Hi. I love your program.
Thank you.
I just have a question about what is a spy? And are we being a little naive in thinking that we do not have spies in Iran? And who would be these spies? And a spy is a person who passes information. And I'm just questioning what kind of evidence do we have that, in fact, she hasn't been passing information. No, she's not a spy in the classical sense.
Well, it's a hard question, please. Yeah.
Can I address that, Tom?
Because, yes, please, Karim.
I don't believe for one second that the regime itself believes the charges that they've leveled against her. In fact, I've spoken to 2 Iranian diplomats over the past couple of months, and mm-hmm. they told me they have no doubts that the charges against her are baseless. So, you know, Mike was talking earlier about several Iranian Americans who were imprisoned in Tehran. And I think at that time, the atmosphere with the Bush administration talking about, you know, democracy promotion and regime change, et cetera, at that time, the Iranians, I think, much more did believe that there were certain individuals working for NGOs and scholars, and they were part of this covert plan to foment a velvet revolution in Iran. I think that their concerns were, in my opinion, unfounded, but they were genuine, they were earnest. In Roxana's case, I don't believe for a second that they believe the charges against her, that she was a spy, because anyone who knows her knows that she had been working as a journalist. She was very cautious. I worked with her, you know, whenever I was in Tehran, and of all the journalists I work with, by far she was the most cautious and taking steps not to offend the sensibilities of the authorities. Her political coverage was fairly moderate. She was moderate and she was very cautious in terms of the people she would meet with. So in this case, I don't believe for a second that the regime itself believes the charges against her.
And now she's sitting in prison. Let's get another perspective on this young woman. From Fargo, North Dakota, moving from Tehran to Fargo, we're joined by Charlie Johnson, general manager at the NBC TV affiliate KVLY in Fargo. He's a former teacher, boss, and mentor to Roxana Saberi. He taught her broadcast journalism for 2 semesters at Concordia College in Moorhead, Minnesota, across the border there. Later hired her to work at KVLY. Charlie Johnson, thank you very much for being with us.
My pleasure. Thanks for inviting me.
You've known her longer than any of us. Introduce Roxana Saberi to us a little more deeply here. What kind of person is this? What kind of motivations? What do you think took her back to Iran for 6 full years, and what do you think of her sitting now in prison?
Well, that's several questions. Let me start with the last one. I think everyone who knows her here hates the fact that she's sitting in prison. And I can't tell you how helpless everyone here feels, because there's not a doggone thing anybody can do.
You've got yellow ribbons on the trees in Fargo.
Yeah, I'm sure that's going to get, you know, it's a wonderful thing. In fact, there's going to be a rally on the bridge between Fargo and Moorhead on Saturday. Mm-hmm. Hopefully a lot of people will show up wearing yellow. So all we can really do is, you know, exhibit our support for her. And certainly many of us have called the congressional delegations, can you please do whatever you can, and they assure us that they're working behind the scenes. So from that standpoint, it's very frustrating for everyone here who knows her and feels so helpless, kind of, you know, just were one step further along the helplessness ladder than her parents. I mean, it's very difficult for them too, I think, but at least they're there, and her dad has some connections.
Yeah, but who knows where that goes? I mean, I'm reading he's been taken in or brought in for some kind of conversation with authorities today. I mean, we've heard her reporting. You know, she's clearly smart. Mike has worked with her. Kareem knows her. You know, this is a formidable person.
Right.
Beautiful. We see in the images, but introduces to us as a character. How do you think she saw her mission in journalism or her mission in Iran?
I think it probably must have evolved over the years. I mean, when she was a student and when she worked here, she was always very driven. She's not a real, I don't think anyone would call her a real extrovert, at least she wasn't at that time,
mm-hmm.
but she just quietly was driven and wanted to follow these paths, and she didn't let anything get in her way. If you looked at her resume, you'd see that she didn't, it was 2 years after she graduated from college that we finally got her to come to work here. You know, we tried to hire her for a long time, but she had other things she wanted to do first. She had master's degrees she wanted to pursue, different things she wanted to do, places she wanted to go. So she always kind of had it in her head, even when she worked here and when she was a student, that she wanted to end up as a foreign correspondent. And I think it was very natural for her to want to go to her father's homeland and learn more about it. From being right on the ground there and learn more about what he told her and learn more about the people of Iran instead of just hearing what we hear, you know, from correspondents who send us messages back from there. And I think, you know, I was glad to hear one of your other guests say that he doesn't think those people believe the charges against her at all. She certainly didn't go there to be a spy. And it seems to me that if the leadership in Iran was thinking properly, they would embrace a person like Roxana, because I think she wanted to go there and tell a different story about Iran than the enemy aspect of it that we get so often.
Mm. We've got Charlie Johnson with us from Fargo, North Dakota, who taught and hired Roxana Saberi. You've spoken with her when she's back in the States during these 6 years. How did you sense her evolving relationship with Iran, her sense of Iran? Was she intimidated, angry, upset, or warming to the culture, or I guess you could do both at the same time?
Yeah, I don't think she was ever really intimidated. When she first went over there, I think there was a touch of nervousness on her part. But she usually would come back here, you know, over the holidays when she'd come home to visit her parents. The last time she did was right around the time that they took her press credentials away. That's the last time I saw her. Mm-hmm. And she was a little concerned about that, but since she was going back, she thought everything would be okay. Several times she talked to me about how she had a minder, you know, they had someone assigned to her when she was reporting. I don't know if that continued after they took her credentials away, but I'm sure they kept close track of her. So I don't think she was ever worried or intimidated. I think she had a great self-confidence that somehow she was going to be okay with them, and they were going to be okay with her. I don't, and again, it's been probably 2 years since I actually got to talk to her, so I think that may have changed, obviously. But
did you say, hey, wait a minute, Roxana, no credentials in Iran? You know, they don't recognize her American citizenship, as I understand it.
Right.
I mean, that's a little, you know, that's going a little naked there, isn't it?
Yeah, I think we all said, are you sure you want to go back then? I mean, don't you want to come home? And she said, no, I've got more to do. And at that time, she was starting to talk about doing a book, you know, and she wanted to
do it. She's reportedly, she's working on a book on Iranian culture. And
right. Yeah, I'm sitting here, I was listening to you guys earlier, I pulled out a book that she gave me when she left here. It's actually a translation of 20th century writings from the original Persian that her dad did, you know. She obviously was very interested in the culture and wanted to go and learn about it. And, you know, I mean, if you'd allow me, I'd have a question for your other guests. I'm kind of curious about how her relationship with Gobadi, the filmmaker, might have affected the perception they have of her there.
We've got just 50 seconds before the break. Mike Schuster, in any sense, or Kareem, this is the Kurdish Iranian filmmaker who we heard sitting, you know, falling down in tears when she was taken away. What about that relationship, Mike, Kareem?
Well, for me, she didn't divulge much about her personal life, so that came as a surprise for me. I didn't know about this relationship. And I think, at least for some people who she met, like myself, I think she kept her journalistic work separate from her private life.
Yeah. Kareem, any sense that could have been a problem or not a big deal?
That wasn't any problem. I agree with what Mike said.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking about Iranian-American journalist Roxana Saberi out of Fargo, North Dakota, now in prison in Iran on an 8-year espionage sentence and, we're told, on hunger strike. Her Iranian-American father, Reza, there working hard to try and get her out. She's at the center of a great big round of geopolitics, maybe Iranian politics as well. Mike Schuster is with us from Culver City, California, NPR correspondent, diplomatic correspondent, spent a lot of time in Iran, and with Roxana. Karim Sajidpour, who also knows her, is with us. He's a scholar with the Carnegie Endowment for International Peace. He first met Roxana in Tehran in 2004. Nancy in Boston, you're on the air.
Tom, in the beginning of the program, it was mentioned that both President Obama and President Ahmadinejad were on this case. What is Ahmadinejad's stance on this one-day trial and this sentence? And also, what type of communication has there been between the White House and the Iranian administration about this?
Good questions. I don't know if we can answer the latter. I mean, President Obama has publicly expressed concern. So has Secretary of State Hillary Clinton. Mike Schuster, we've got reports out of Iran of Mahmoud Ahmadinejad and the chief of the country's judiciary being quoted stressing that Roxana Saberi should receive a quick and fair appeal. So he's, you know, he's publicly on the record about this. But what about where he might stand and where communications might stand? Do we know anything, Mike?
We don't know much, and what we do know is puzzling. The statement from Ahmadinejad, which seemed to be somewhat of a soft statement coming from the president of Iran, was a surprise. And it's difficult to interpret because there are oftentimes Ahmadinejad does say contradictory things. The one thing that we should note about his effect on this trial is that he doesn't control the judiciary. And he doesn't control the intelligence ministry, which apparently brought the case against or made whatever case was made against Roxana, that they operate independently. The president of Iran doesn't have control over them. Mm-hmm. And so what motivated Ahmadinejad's statement is a puzzle to me. It's difficult to say. And there have also been contradictory things coming out of the court that don't give us much guidance at all about what they intend to do.
You've now got Shirin Ebadi, the Iranian human rights activist who won the Nobel Peace Prize in 2003, working on this case. Karim Sajidpour, what do you make of Ahmadinejad speaking of the case? And are there back channels here? How does that work? We're represented through the Swiss in Iran. Do we have more than that now with Obama in office?
Well, a couple of points I would make. First, when you talk to people like Shirin Ebadi, the 2003 Nobel Peace Prize winner, Iranian human rights attorney, they will tell you that it's essential that in cases like this, when innocent Americans or innocent Iranians, political prisoners have been detained, it's imperative that we go very public with this, and the media and civil society and human rights groups should cause an outcry over this. But U.S. government pressure should be carefully calibrated because, you know, the behind-the-scenes pressure is very useful, especially if it's multilateral. If it's not just the U.S. government, but you have several governments throughout the world giving Iran the same talking points. But public demands from the Iranian government, you know, from U.S. officials imploring them to release Roxana, issuing threats, etc., is oftentimes perceived as unconstructive because the Iranians are less likely to respond to U.S. pressures. Now, I think to the credit of the Obama administration, they have walked that line, I think, very carefully between expressing disappointment and Roxana's imprisonment, but at the same time kind of being respectful of Iranian authorities, not giving them any more reason to continue to hold on to them. Now, in the case of President Ahmadinejad, he's in a somewhat delicate position in the sense that his most powerful clerical backers are these hardliners who are not interested in having an amicable relationship with the United States. At the same time, as we've been talking about, he's up for re-election June 12th of this year, and he has to appeal to a very young electorate, which is overwhelmingly in favor of having a rapprochement with the United States. And he has to balance these two positions, which are essentially irreconcilable. That's why, as Mike said, we hear, you know, things that are quite inconsistent and contradictory from him. On one week, he'll denounce the United States. The next week, he'll call for, you know, he will say he's open to relations with the United States. But ultimately, I think, you know, these hardliners in Tehran, they want to, in my opinion, sabotage any hopes of a detente. But at the same time, they don't want to be seen as the saboteurs. They don't want the... That's why the Bush administration was so useful for them, because they could blame everything on the Bush administration and Dick Cheney for being the impediments to this U.S.-Iran relationship. It's much more difficult for them to do with the Obama administration. And again, I don't think they want to be perceived in the eyes of their own people as the impediment to Iran's isolation.
That's
and the impediment to this
tough position to be in for Ahmadinejad, then, if he needs to look magnanimous here with his own electorate at home, who's maybe more worldly, liberal-minded than the hardliners. At the same time, the hardliners are his, that's his base, right? So kind of a rock and a hard place for him.
Well, actually, I mean, they've so far, and I would focus more on Ayatollah Khamenei than Ahmadinejad.
Supreme leader.
Who's the supreme leader. He's been in office for 20 years now, since the death of the revolution's father, Ayatollah Khomeini. And I don't believe for a second that someone like Roxana, who is a U.S. citizen, could have been imprisoned without Khamenei's consent. I believe that he would have had to tacitly approve of this, especially for her to be imprisoned now for 3 months. And again, I think he's someone who understands this argument that many of us have made throughout the years, that if you engage Iran, you open up its economy. You try to bring Iran back into the global community. That this is going to facilitate political reform. Khamenei understands that argument very well, and for precisely that reason, I think he's either deeply ambivalent or opposed to an opening. But again, he recognizes he's presiding over a very young population that wants to have this relationship. He doesn't, you know, sabotage things openly. He doesn't rebuff the U.S. necessarily openly, but he has ways of kind of doing it behind the scenes. So it appears that he's staying above the fray and he's out of it. But I think behind the scenes, he certainly has a role in all of this.
I can't tell if that whole formula means that it leans toward her, you know, being sprung out of there pretty soon or in there for a long time. Champaign, Illinois. Tony, you're on the air.
Yeah, hello. Hi. I was just wondering if Cheney had an Iranian who he thought might be a spy, he might want to waterboard her, I would think. So I was just wondering what your panel thinks the chances are that Saberi is being tortured, and I'll hang up. Thanks.
Tony, thank you. Mike, I mean, I've got another, you know, here's one from online, onpointradio.org. This is from Steven saying, I agree the sentencing and imprisonment is terrible and unjust, but how can we decry it or have moral grounds for outrage when we've detained and imprisoned so many innocent Middle Eastern men who were not tried or charged for any crimes and tortured them as well? I'm looking at this op-ed piece saying, Mike, that the online Iranian newspaper Ruz reported that she has been told, Roxana Saberi has been told, that if she quote-unquote confesses and name names about her alleged espionage contacts, and if those were more moderate opponents of the hardliners, she would be let out. I mean, Tony puts a really blunt question on it. Would she be tortured? And he's going to dig for Dick Cheney there as well. But, I mean, how far do you see things potentially going here for the people who've got her in there to get what they want if this is politically motivated, Mike?
Well, there has been violence on activists, particularly Iranian activists, who have been put in prison, and some have died. And as I mentioned earlier, there was an Iranian-Canadian journalist who was beaten to death and probably raped in prison a few years ago. I think there's always the possibility.
Is it a woman
violence.
Or a man or what?
It was a woman, and I think it was there was always the possibility. Jeez. Violence hangs over this place and these cases. But I think that in the case of Iranian Americans, like the four scholars a couple of years ago and like Roxana now, I think that the authorities there are quite careful about the way they treat them. They want them to say certain things, and they will hold them in prison for a number of months until they get it or until the situation changes or until Ayatollah Khamenei decides that it is no longer useful to keep them in prison. So the violence is always a threat. but at least historically against this kind of prisoner, it hasn't been used extensively.
Hopefully, with the prominence of her case, it might augur against it. Let's go to Green Bay, Wisconsin. Saeed, you're on the air, Saeed.
Hello, Tom.
Hi.
I think the arrest of Ms. Sabari is one of a series of events that the state uses to control media in Iran. They control the media, not just the media that is consumed by the Iranians themselves, but they control international reporting an example for is Zahra Kazemi, the Canadian Iranian Canadian reporter who was arrested and died in prison in their custody because she was reporting on arrest of students in Tehran University. There is a red line that every reporter in Iran knows that if you cross into areas that the state does not want explored, that you will be imprisoned, tortured, killed, or deported. And the result is that the reporting from Iran that we get in the West is quite flawed. For example, in this election cycle, the election is being pitted as a contention between the reformists, the quote-unquote reformists, yeah, and the hardliners, whereas the real political contention in Iran is not between the various factions of the Islamic Republic, but it is between the Khomeiniist tyrants and the vast majority of Iranians who are trying to displace this government and are fighting for rights.
And you think even foreign correspondents are intimidated by what they've seen?
Absolutely. Foreign correspondents are intimidated. Example is a reporter from the McNeil Lehrer News Hour was in Iran reporting, and she was supposed to report for 5 days, a 15-minute segment every day.
Yep.
She reported for 2 days. On the third day, she was going to interview the parents of an Iranian student activist who was murdered in prison, and she was immediately deported. They control international media, and the result is that the truth of the struggle of the Iranian people for freedom is not being told in the West.
Saeed, thanks for your call. It's intimidating to be in prison, and we're told Roxana's dad says she's already lost 10 pounds on this hunger strike. But Mike, what about when you're just out and about? I mean, is Saeed right? Is it that scary there? Can it be?
I've never felt fearful when I've been in Iran, and I've been in Iran many times in the last 5 years. But there are certain stories that I'll gather information for in Iran and then report on them when I leave Iran and finish the stories. But usually on human rights issues, it's clear that there have been times when American and European reporters have been expelled from the country for stories like that. And I found that gathering the information and gathering the string and then reporting when I get out of Iran has worked. And in fact, I've done a number of stories about human rights violations in Iran, the most recent one in February. There's a case of a couple of doctors who are AIDS doctors who have been in prison. And it seems the only reason they've been in prison, and this is now nearly a year, is because they went to international medical meetings to talk about how others in different parts of the world deal with AIDS, and they were put in prison. They have been convicted and sentenced and are serving prison sentences. These are Iranians, not Iranian Americans.
But I'm just talking about AIDS treatment, and they end up in prison.
I know. Essentially, the view that I picked up in Tehran is that there is pressure on Iranians not to have people-to-people contact with the outside world or with Americans, and the authorities used the Bush administration as the boogeyman in this. I think the case of these two doctors is quite serious, but I reported on them in the context of other human rights violations when I left Iran. I think I felt that was safer for me and better for the story.
And now, though, as Karim says, you've got a young population, as Karim describes, yearning for something quite different. It surely wouldn't look very good to them to have this young, attractive Iranian-American woman hurt or maybe even in prison for too long. Jeff is in Dracut, Massachusetts. Jeff, you're on the air.
Hi, Tom. My wife is Iranian. My in-laws came from Tehran, Iran, about 20 years ago. Mm-hmm. And my mother-in-law goes back every couple years, and she's often talked to us about going there and experiencing the culture, because it is a beautiful culture with wonderful food and just architecture and everything.
I can attest to that, yeah.
And I'm in law enforcement, and I've often been my reasons for not going is for the simple reason of what's happened to the young lady in Tehran right now, is that to be viewed as some form of spy, you know, because of the paranoid sense which exists in the government there.
Yeah, Jeff, our time is short, but we can hear that even with a wife from Iran as an American. Kareem Sajatpour, we're going to have to wrap on that. But take us through. Here's Jeff, you know, an American who'd like to go and enjoy this country and this culture, but this is part of a great big picture, as is, as you point out, Roxana Sabri's imprisonment there. How does all this, I mean, there's her fate. Where do you think this goes, and what? How does this augur for Obama's effort to open up this relationship? Does this say, forget about it, they'll do anything to stop it? Is she going to get out of there, and maybe we roll on?
Yeah, well, let me answer your last question first, Tom, because as we've been talking about throughout this program, the reason, in my opinion, and I think Mike's as well, that these hardliners have imprisoned Roxana is to sabotage any hope of rapprochement, because they recognize that they can... They thrive when the relationship with the United States is adversarial, but they fear, you know, politically and financially, the repercussions of a U.S.-Iran rapprochement. And I think, you know, in the past, the U.S. government has always reacted to these spoilers by ceasing confidence building with Iran, which is precisely what they're hoping to achieve.
Right.
And, you know, I think in this case, the Obama administration understands the impetus for these spoilers doing what they're doing, and they're going to continue onward with engagement, but at some point there's going to be, you know, on the Hill among congressmen and senators, there's going to be a lot of pressure and backlash and saying, you know, why are we continuing to reach out to these people while they're continuing to enrich uranium, imprisoning U.S. citizens, etc. So it's going to be a tough one for the Obama administration to continue onward with.
We've got 10 seconds. What can Americans do for Roxana Sabri?
Then continue to make a lot of noise. That's what we can do. Continue to make sure that her case is heard throughout the world. And I'm optimistic that she will be released before the presidential elections in June.
Well, we're here, right now, making that noise. Kareem Sajatpour with the Carnegie Endowment for International Peace in Washington. Kareem, thank you very much for joining us.
Thank you.
And NPR's Mike Schuster. Mike, wonderful to have you. Thank you.
Thank you.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.